And I hope I haven't, yes, and I hope I haven't, just let me get rid of this. Got it. I hope I haven't left one out because I can't think of another one, but there might have been another one invented since I did all this. Anyway, to get back to physical illness and autonomic training, I just want to say we've got the renal system, the reproductive system, and the endocrine system. And those are the three I'm going to cover. I think I've got an hour, have I? An hour and a bit,
Well,
Jane.
we're just, this is, we're
Swap it
swapping.
round.
We
Yeah.
must, we have swapped it round. The students don't know this yet. So if you need to get the notes out,
Oh, sorry.
we're going to do that first.
Yeah.
But Anne, I think you've got the morning. You've got
Oh,
from,
excellent. Yeah, good.
so I think this is how it is, and there maybe will be
Okay,
other things.
when I get to the end of this, we'll have the coffee.
Yes.
And then after that, we'll do the Rossi and the Ultradian here and all of that.
Yes,
Okay,
yeah,
jolly good. So
perfect.
the renal system, the reproductive system, and the endocrine system. But before doing that, I just want to remind you, because I don't know, sort of how you're engaging in this, but we're not, as autogenic therapists, ever treating anything. So I mean, however alarming or odd that it might be that somebody might have, you're not treating that at all. You are dealing with a person who has that condition. They may or may not have come to you because of that condition, or they will have a condition as part of whatever else they brought to you. And in sort of your when you have the assessment and you get the background and their previous health, it may be that one of these conditions comes up, and you know, just look it up, because the more that you know, the more that you've got in your head, just in case anything does come up. And you can always be open to someone talking about the condition and their treatment and so on. And so you can be like a supporter or a confidant or whatever, because they'll probably be seeing other, specialists or their doctor or this and that. Might have gone right, it might have gone wrong, it might have done this. So you can actually explore the person's experience of having this, or it might be that they've got something in their background and it never crops up at all. But if it's there, look it up. So the more you inform yourself, the better equipped you are if anything does. And just remember that you are never treating someone. You are perhaps making a difference to the way that they are living with this condition. Okay. So the renal system. Okay. So, and again, in these short introductions I've given, it is just a structure and a function. It's no great depth at all about anything. So it's just to sort of set the scene of what there is and what those things do, which can be useful if you know basically how things work. So the renal system is made up of the kidneys. Okay, the kidneys, the ureters, and these are tubes that go from the kidney down to the bladder, and they obviously they are a thoroughfare, a pipe for the urine that's secreted in the kidneys to get down to the bladder. You've got the bladder, which stores the urine, and you've got the urethra, which is a transit tube to the outside. So looking at that, you've got two kidneys. What we do know now, which perhaps we didn't know many years ago, was in actual fact you can manage with one. So kidney transplants are to a penny now, apparently. Well, perhaps not as much as that, but they are not uncommon. They started, I don't know when it was, probably in the 50s, 60s, kidney transplants. And they are, I think, of all the transplanting organs that is done, I think they're probably the simplest one, and there's more available because, of course, as you probably know, people donate kidneys. So A kidney can come up in conversation or something someone's done, or it might be that they've had the kidney, whatever. So there's kidney and taking one out or only having one is apparently they're quite capable of doing the job of two. So I suppose you could wonder why we have two evolutionary. I don't know the answer to that. Can think about that. We've only got one heart, which can be a bit of a problem. We've got one liver, we've got two kidneys. Interesting. Okay. The kidneys, actually, the function of the kidney is to control the body's biochemistry, particularly salt metabolism. And they're incredibly, I mean, we think that, the sort of IT thing is clever and unbelievable, but what's going on in our bodies is absolutely unbelievable. They control salt metabolism, and it also controls fluid ba balance and is known as an excretory organ. So, it's a filtration system. All the liquid and the fluid and the blood and everything goes through the kidneys, who filter it, and they filter out water and salts, which then actually are put into the it goes through an incredible length of tubules that actually reabsorb or allow the water in the urine. So it's incredibly complicated. They're filtering it, and the filtration goes through a series of tubes till it actually gets to the state where it gets into the ureter and is excreted. So it's all very complicated stuff going on. And it goes into the bladder, and that's happening all the time. And the bladder is a storehouse, and we all know how the bladder works. It's a bladder is something that you can blow up and can be very small. So we all know that when there is enough urine in there, we get a signal, and the signal comes from the stretching cells in the lining of the bladder. And also there's a sphincter. We know what a sphincter is, a sphincter at the outlet, and this sphincter is under the control of stretch receptors. So it begins to give you back, it gives back impulses to you to know that you want to pee. And so we can hold on to that for, some people are good at this and some people aren't good at this. And we can hold on to that for as long as we can, and then it needs to be voided, and then it goes out from the bladder. We release the control of the sphincter by our higher consciousness, and it actually goes out through the urethra. So it's a sort of, can say it's a fairly simple system, but what the kidney does is incredibly complex. And of course, like all these systems, absolutely wonderful. The conditions of the renal system, and these are not uncommon because they're ones that we've all had anyway. I would imagine we've all had problems one way and another with this, that, and the other. So we've got infections, which is cystitis. Now, that's just a term for itis. Itis of anything is inflammational. So if you've got itis of your cyst, you've got an inflammation in the bladder. And I think most women, and here we are, separate out, most women, and some men obviously, most women will be very familiar with an attack of cystitis, be it something that's just clears itself or something that needs treatment. And that is something that stays locally in the bladder. But if it starts, so everything that stays down in the bladder or the urethra is localized. However unpleasant it might be, it's localized. If the infection starts to travel up the urethra, it gets more serious. And you have then got what you call pyelonephritis, where you actually have the infection going in to the kidney, and to medulla of the kidney. And then you've got glomerulonephritis, which is an infection of the kidney. Now, things are getting very serious there, because if you have a nephritis, you can actually then have a loss of function of the kidney, that can be something that actually leads to the necessity for a transplant. Or before transplant, there was what do you call it? When you have the when you have your or what I've lost a word. I've lost a word.
Dialysis,
Yeah, thank you, thank you,
dialysis.
thank you, thank you. Lost a
Sorry.
word. You have dialysis. Now, dialysis. Are you going to be seeing someone on dialysis? You might not. But that is a life consuming. Do you want to say something, Jane, about dialysis? You've got
No,
the look on.
oh, no, I was agreeing with you. I think it'd be very unlikely we would ever see anybody that, sorry.
So, the next another thing is that is enuresis, which is when you can't control that. So of course we think of that as mostly belonging to childhood and young people, but it can be caused in adult life by other things, by pressure on the bladder, by disease, and so on, or actually by a neurological condition. So enuresis is the inability to control voiding from the bladder. So that can be that it hasn't been trained, which is in the one with children, that the maturity of this of the control of the sphincter has not been obtained. That can go up into early adulthood. It can go into adulthood, but it mostly confined to childhood, one way or another. And it can be considered to be a fairly normal part of childhood. But later in life and in adulthood, it isn't. And it would then be something that it might crop up that, if someone has got this, which of course would be causing distress and so on. So that's the thing. Stress incontinence, again, this is mostly a female problem. Where the tone of the muscles that surround the bladder and the ligaments that hold the bladder up have all been stretched by something rather large in the abdomen, which is usually babies. So this is fairly much a woman a female problem, and the more babies a woman has, the more she's likely to have a degree of that, or sometimes a really life debilitating problem, which is dealt with surgically, by slinging up the bladder again. With there's been a lot in the press recently about the scandal of using a certain method of mesh that was put in to hold the bladder up, which caused an untold problems afterwards. I think it's all going on. Obstruction.
Anne, may I
Yes.
make just one comment
Yeah.
that stress incontinence doesn't actually mean when somebody is under a lot of stress. It's more about the
No,
physical
no,
thing
no,
of
no, no.
laughing or sneezing
Yeah,
or
yeah, yeah,
coughing.
yeah. Thank you. Yeah,
Yeah, yes.
yes. But you're absolutely right, but there is another stress incontinence as well. But
Yeah, of
mostly,
course.
what I was meaning and thinking that the stress is having a cough.
Yeah,
Yes,
yeah.
and there's nothing more annoying than when you've had children and babies coughing. Oh God, here we go. Now obstruction. I have got obstruction to voiding from the bladder. You've got for men, you have prostatic hypertrophy because the prostate gland sits around the urethra, and if that actually enlarges, which is one of the male things thing for a man to look forward to, and poor Sebastian sitting there thinking about this or not thinking about this or not listening. It's a very common condition in men, I'm sure
I
you know.
heard, and I have
What?
a crop. I heard, I know, and I came across a lot of people with this problem, this condition. I was
Yes.
surprised actually how often, after a certain age, they tend to get a problem with their bladder.
Which, people can manage or they can't, or they need interventions. And of course, you've prostatic cancer is a very common one, and I think that for men, the prostate is a worry as in later life. In terms of the hypertrophy, which is when the prostate for some reason begins to sort of grow and press on the fat, it can cause obstruction to the bladder, which is of course is a nuisance, and that might need to be operated on. But the treatment, and of course for prostate cancer, there is now a test for your prostate, PP, prostate antigen, prostate PSA, your prostate specific antigen, and that's often done. And if that's raised, then people would follow it up. There's a lot said about prostatic cancer that it isn't always treated, so there's not a one size fits all for prostatic cancer. But I think in terms of men getting older, the prostate is something that can be a bit of a problem. And it's almost an inevitable, the prostatic hypertrophy is almost inevitable, but not necessarily life-changing. And you've got renal stones. Now, they are very acute and very disabling. If you have renal stones, you're in a lot of trouble, and often after a first episode end up in hospital, and you either pass the stones or they have to be removed. So that's a very specific thing. And that the renal stones often comes from the metabolism of the diet and fluid balance as well. So that but kidney stones are not uncommon. Bladder cancer is and kidney cancer are quite common cancers. Now, you won't be treating those, but you might be seeing someone who has had any of those or who knows someone. And again, it's actually just being open to a conversation about someone who might want to talk about this, or might have had bladder cancer or still having treatment. So you are in a supporting role in that you're giving someone a resource, an internal resource to help whatever's going on. Probably know about Lumania as well, which is that's the stress bit of that one, with anxiety causing faulty messages from the bladder. So the Lumania is actually a faulty message coming from the bladder that you need to pee, you need to pee, you need to pee. So people get, and I think this is Sebastian,
It's
correct me
very.
if I'm wrong, is it?
No, you're right. And I just want to emphasize, especially during periods when I was under stress, like, I had to sit an exam. Before the exam, I had the urge to go to toilet even for a few drops, and I think that is where I'm wrong, Lumania. When you have the urge to go to toilet very often, but that is caused by stress or distress. Is this correct?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
I know.
Yeah.
It's very
And
unpleasant.
yes, and it's quite disabling, because what's one of those things, once you've got it, you're a bit stuck with it. Jane.
Pardon.
Lou.
Luther suggested that he never used the term lumania, but frequency of urination he described as a crying need. So if we do intentional crying exercises when we have that problem, I'm not denying stress and everything that's been said, of course, but when we know that this doesn't actually fit, the body isn't working in the way that we, and we know it's only an exam, and we don't, it's only a few drops, so we know this and that and the other. Crying need might be underneath it. That's the point.
Well, who knows? Yeah. Always good to have these
It
extra thought, extra autogenic training thoughts in these conditions. Yeah. So to get to autogenic training, anybody want to say anything more about kidneys, the bladder function and all the rest of it, and prostates and so on? Did you want to go there? Yeah.
Yeah, it's just a quick question. I don't have great medical knowledge, but I guess the water coming into the kidneys, is that coming from the stomach?
It's in the blood. The blood takes it through and it's filtered out of the blood.
Right, so it's the blood going into the kidneys. Okay,
It
got it.
circulates around the kidneys, with
Yeah.
the renal arteries, and the kidney actually extracts what it wants from the blood. It extracts salt and water, and then it refines it through a series of tubules to produce urine, which has got waste products, and then that goes down to the bladder. So it's taken to the kidney via the blood. The
Okay.
blood,
Yeah,
yeah.
thank you for that.
So autogenic training will reduce anxiety. So, I mean, any condition that you've got that one has can cause frustration, anxiety, and anger, and all sorts of things. So, the offloading and personal affirmations can support the voluntary part of the bladder functions, the personal affirmations, because we've got the voluntary and the involuntary. So that can be helpful in terms of your waterworks. Anything else anybody wants to contribute? Yes, Sebastian.
Sorry, I just have one question. Oh, sorry, one question. I tend to drink sometimes over 4 liter of water a day. Is that a problem?
I don't think so. Your kidneys can deal with anything. I think in terms of what the kidneys, we are encouraged to drink water because it's good. The kidneys can deal with anything unless they are themselves diseased. Glomerulonephritis came with scarlet fever, and then you can have pyelonephritis, which is due to bacterial conditions. So you can have, if you can have a non-functioning kidney, the kidneys aren't functioning, you're in trouble. So they wouldn't be able to deal with that. But as a healthy kidney can pretty well, unless you go overboard and really drink gallons and gallons, whereupon that might not do you any good. But we are encouraged to drink water, and I think not drinking water, and particularly as you're getting older, actually is more of a problem than drinking too much. The trouble with drinking too much water when you're getting older, and I can vouch for this, you keep having to go to the loo, and you can't walk very well, like I can't. It's a blooming nuisance. So there's balance and sense in all sorts of things. But no, your kidneys can be got two healthy kidneys. It's making them continue to work, isn't it? Yeah. So kidney stones are often because of concentration and not having enough. And someone, who goes out and drinks a lot and doesn't drink water, they can become a bit dehydrated, and that can cause kidney stones, which is simply a solidification of some of the salts that the kidney is excreting. So again, the renal system, a wondrous system. Do we agree? Yes, we do. We do. Now, the next one is the reproductive system. Okay. So we've got the reproductive. So here we're going to really split off the men and the women. We've got the reproductive system in the women, and we've got the reproductive system in men. Interesting. So let's start with the reproductive system of in women, what it is made up of. So it's made up of two ovaries, the uterus or the womb, the fallopian tubes, the vagina, the labia, and the breasts. They're all quite highly emotive words, aren't they? One way or another, a bit different to kidneys and things like that, and liver. So we've got let's tie up the ovaries, start with the ovaries, which are in the pelvis. Now, interestingly enough, when we do AT, we don't get down to the pelvis. And I think it was Kay Kamani who said, why didn't we have a pelvic exercise, which is lower down? We stop at the abdomen, which is an interesting question for which I have no answer. So perhaps you can have an answer about that one. So we've got two ovaries which sit in the pelvis, and they are attached to the fallopian tubes, or the fallopian tubes come from the ovaries, and they actually deliver eggs down into the uterus or the womb, where they may or may not be fertilized. Again, we've got this wonderful system, but here we're not dealing with just simply with one person. We've got two people involved here, perhaps. So then we've got the vagina, and then we've got the labia, which are the two lips either side of the vagina, which to some extent protect the vagina. And then we've got the breasts, which is a whole world of its own, or of their own. So if you look at the bit that I've written, we've got conditions of the female reproductive system and issues surrounding them. And there is a long list, a very long list. And you look at that and you could think, I mean, that's a minefield. And you could think to yourself, how is it that women actually survive all of that? And then you can think, well, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. So I think there must be something in that women have to undergo a possibility of all those things and still end up however they are. So let's start with the menstrual cycle. So I think that's something that we would all have a view on, depending on how it went. So we've got a woman is very fortunate if she starts her periods, starts menstruating in early teenage, and has a monthly bleed, a regular monthly bleed, which is containable, not painful, and goes on her way. Now, if you have that, you are blessed indeed, because I don't think there's one, two, three, four, one, two, three, six women here. I think I'm all right. One, two, three, four, five, six. Put your hands up if you had a cycle like that. Right. Oh, you did. Well, good for you. Never any trouble with your menstrual cycle. Well, one in six. You were blessed. Bev, you did.
Yeah, until I hit perimenopause. Right. And it all changed. But up until then, yeah, regular, no real issues at all.
That's interesting. Bev, have you got away through the menopause as well without any problems to do with your cycle?
No, I'm still menstruating.
Yeah. Patricia, did you get through everything without any problems, right through the menopause as well? You're muted.
We can't.
Yeah. You're muted.
The answer was yes. Yes, I was very fortunate all the way through.
Well, you are. One in a million, I think. Yes, yeah, so everybody else had problems. So you can have problems with the bleeding, problems with the cycle, the irregularity, and problems with pain, albeit pain. So there's a lot there. So you're very lucky, Tricia, and you've escaped quite a lot. There's also a condition, and this you may well come across in your of premenstrual tension, which is actually, as we all know about that, an emotional condition as you come up towards your period, which is to do with the hormonal control of the cycle. And some women's lives are absolutely blighted by premenstrual tension. And they become another person. I mean, you know all this. They become another person. And so I think that you may have people who, if they haven't come to you because of premenstrual tension, that they actually have it as a part of their whole reason for coming. Donna, we've got next thing is endometriosis. Am I remembering correctly? Yes. Endometriosis is a very horrible condition. Do you mind me saying?
Donna
has, which is where when you're menstruating, the lining of the womb is shed because you haven't had a fertilized egg put into it. Because every month, the lining of every month, the womb prepares itself for a fertilized egg to implant. And in that month, it has changes. So if we go, do you want to hear this or you want to hear this or? Yeah. So when you have finished your period, the lining of the womb has shed itself, all the cells and all the rest of it, because it hasn't had a fertilized egg implant itself into the wall. So in shedding itself, it then, in the first part of the cycle, so we're into the next cycle now, in the first part of that cycle, it begins to build up and repair the lining of the womb. So the lining of the womb thickens and gets ready, and in the middle of the cycle, the ovary lays an egg. And this egg comes down the fallopian tube into the womb. Now, when forget that it's been fertile. The ovulation occurs in the middle of the cycle. And with that, new hormones are produced, the progesterone, which then tidies up the lining of the womb, which has been building itself up. It makes it ready to receive the egg. So it's got changes. Okay. And it gets. Are we ready? Are we working it? So it gets into the wrong places where it shouldn't be. That tissue then begins to behave as if it was still in the womb. Donna, you had this, and it is a disabling and life changing condition, isn't it?
Yes, sorry, I was muted. Yeah. It's horrible, completely devastating. Yeah.
And I think
it's very painful.
Yeah.
Excruciating. It's like being in childbirth sometimes.
Oh my goodness me. Okay. Wow.
And not easily treated. there are various, Donna would know, there's various things, you know, to stop up, to stop menstruation, to stop ovulation, to stop all this going on. But a very disabling, physically and mentally, emotionally disabling condition. Mm. And I think, Donna, if you don't mind, I think you came on the autogenic training course originally because you were at the hospital and did the course and then inspirationally decided to become therapist. And here we are.
Absolutely. It just helped. It helped the pain. Didn't change anything.
No.
But it helped me cope with it.
Yes. Goodness me, it's going to take me all day to go through. It's going to take me all day to go through the problems of the female reproductive system. So we've got polycystic ovarian system, which is mostly a hormonal condition, which again is difficult to treat, where you get lack of periods, you get hair growth where you don't want it, and generally very unpleasant. Infertility, miscarriage, termination, that's even before we start on childbirth. Difficulties, the stillbirth, the postnatal depression, we've got infection. And then, goodness me, if you survive all that, you've got the menopause. And in the menopause, you can actually have some. I've come across people who had, like Patricia, sailed through menstrual life without anyone, and suddenly hit the menopause, and it devastates them, absolutely devastates them, with hot flushes, mental fog, and so on and so forth. So as I say, it's a minefield. And then apart from that, we can then on to breast disease. And this is a very high profile condition in our world of breast cancer, a high profile common condition. You can also have breast disease, which is dysmorphia, which is, you know, sort of having very large breasts and wanting breast reduction and so on and so forth. So there's a whole minefield there as well. Any of those things, because it's part of the menstrual cycle, or all of those things are part of the reproductive life of a woman, you can have many, many, many things. And any of those can be a reason for seeking, as with Donna, for seeking sort of some form of internal help with whatever's going on. Does anybody want to say anything more about that list of miscarriage? Termination, I'd have people who had a miscarriage is a tragedy. That will crop up. Yes, Pia.
Well, I'll just mention how AT helped me when I was little. I had my period just before I was 10 years of age, which was terrible because everyone else in my class, they were 30 or 14 and 15 before they had the period. Yeah. But I was so badly affected in when I ovulated and also when I had my period that I just had to stand still like, and I couldn't, and it was terrible. It was so terrible because I actually couldn't do anything about it. When I learned autogenics, and that was 2 years. I learned it when I was 12 years of age and it totally went. I had no problem and my period started to be every month, and it was every month till I was 54. My menopause, I didn't even know that it happened. It just fizzled out. But the first 2 years of my period was absolutely hell. And that was autogenics that helped me. It took me 3 months and there was no problem.
That's
just
amazing.
like that.
That's absolutely amazing. And you brought up the thing about the periods. For some girls, it is so cruel to start the periods in junior school. Really, really cruel. It happens.
But I certainly know it was the autogenics that happened there, definitely.
So a minefield. Yes, Jane. You're muted.
Just a smaller side on that, how autogenics does seem to affect the reproductive system. I always ask women, well, of who are of menstruating age, about their periods, and if they're regular as clockwork. I've learned to say, actually, autogenic training can upset that just temporarily sometimes, but don't worry about it. No need to go and see the gynecologist. A few people over the years, only a few, have said, I don't know quite what's happening there. But then I've always said, well, let's just see how things settle down. And it's always settled down fine. So it's something I sometimes say in assessment. Don't worry if a few little blips happen, either in the regularity or the character of your period, because it's likely to settle back down again. So that's a very small thing in the light of the real conversation we're having now.
But that's two examples of how a practice like autogenic training or whatever it is, you know, what we're doing, that change that occurs in us to wherever we go with it can affect our physiology and function, and we are so interconnected. So that's two stories, Piers and Jane's stories, of how it can affect the cycle. If we go on to the reproductive system in men, Sebastian, you are our token person. So we've got, we haven't got such a long list, have we?
No.
Got a long list. And I do think that those two lists can actually say an awful lot about an experience of being a man and an experience of being a woman. And as I say, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. So maybe all of these reproductive, physiological, menstrual problems that we go through does actually toughen us up, or I don't know, we can have a view on that. To get to the reproductive system in men, it's made up of the testes, producing spermatozoa, which is the germ cell in sperm, semen, yes. We've got the prostate gland, which we've already mentioned, and that produces secretions, which actually are necessary for fertility, interestingly enough. And then you've got the penis, which is there for reproduction, for urination, for pleasure, and for pain. And I think in terms of men, I think the penis can be a bit of a responsibility one way and another. Am I right? It's either doing something it should or something it shouldn't.
Excuse me, Anne. I was just thinking, it's a really busy part of the body, that one, isn't it?
Yes.
Maybe us women should be quite jealous of it. No, we shouldn't. We're fine as we are.
Got enough to contend with. It's also, interestingly, all the female reproductive system, apart from the breasts, are internal. The breasts are external, which gives them a different life, and the penis is external. So there's nothing really very internal in the male reproductive system. It's just quite interesting just to reflect on that incredible difference and the different experience through life of being a man to being a woman. So the conditions of the male reproductive system and the issues associated with them, we've already spoken about prostatic hypertrophy causing urinary obstruction, urinary frequency and cancer. And like the breast cancer is a very common cancer. Whereas breast cancer tends to occur younger, the prostatic cancer tends to be a condition of later life. And it's quite possible that you would have someone who has prostatic cancer coming or has prostatic cancer as part of whatever they've come about. And again, you would find these out in a good case history. Sexual potency and dysfunction. Now there we have the emotional and very male thing about potency and dysfunction. So sexual potency, of course, is whether with all those millions of sperms that are put into the ejaculate, whether they're actually viable. An extraordinary thing is that there are millions and millions, and you have to have a percentage that are properly made and not an irregular size or shape. You have to have a certain amount, even though you've got million, even though there are millions, for that semen to be considered as fertile. So pretty complicated stuff. And sort of diet and habits and drink and so on, and smoking and so lifestyle changes there. And dysfunction, now that is sometimes physical, and sometimes most common is a disorder of emotional stress or disorder, is dealt with like that. The potency one reminds me of something I first heard on a program with Benjamin Zephaniah. You know Benjamin Zephaniah, the poet, the Rastafarian poet. We all know Benjamin Zephaniah, a West Indian poet. he's a West Indian, and he said when he was a young man, he was speaking on a program about male infertility, and he said when he was a young man, so the infertility, and we've got in right. I put at the bottom, relationships are an integral part of these conditions. So you're not really going to get, you're unlikely to get the problems of reproductive system in women or men, particularly in women, where the partner doesn't come in to as part of this. As part of either the problem or as part of this, certainly relationships are an integral part of these conditions, both for men and women, because it's two people too. AT can support the conditions and the treatment recommended and give hope. And then I think offloading, certainly with all that list, is grief, anger, and anxiety. So the offloading would be an important part of that. So that's a lot with the reproductive system, a lot to think about. How am I off the time, Jane? I've got the time in front of me. It's 10:30. So I've got another half hour, have I? Yeah?
You're muted, Jane.
Yeah.
When you finish, Anne, we go and have coffee.
Yes,
as long as you leave enough time after coffee for your next piece. So yeah. That's absolutely fine.
It's actually don't mute during this because all I want people to chip in. So it's, you know, just Donna, unmute so that you can all join in. Yeah. So here we have the endocrine system. And of course, this is an all-encompassing system. So the endocrine system is a system of glands, which secrete hormones. And these are chemical messengers for communication and control of organs, which is an alternative to the communication and control via the nervous system. The pituitary gland is the master gland with feedback systems from the individual glands. Now, we did touch on that in physiology of stress, but the pituitary gland is the master gland, and it has these feedback mechanisms. So this is a complex and another wonderful systems. So we've got the endocrine glands and their secretions. We've got the thyroid gland, which sits on the front of the throat, either side of the larynx. And there are two parts to the thyroid gland, two lobes, one either side of the voice box. We have the pancreas, which is embedded around about inside the liver, around about the gallbladder, around about there. So it's sort of embedded in the liver as part of an abdominal organ. We've got the adrenal glands, which are situated on top of the kidneys. So they're like little hats on top of each kidney. We've got the ovaries, which we have one on each side, which secrete estrogen and progesterone. And we've got the testes, which produce testosterone. And we've got the parathyroid glands, which secrete parathormone, which are attached to the thyroid glands. And there are four of them, and they regulate calcium metabolisms. So the control of the endocrine secretion cascades from higher centers in the brain down through the hypothalamus, the anterior pituitary, to a specific gland, and then circulating hormone reaches the target organ. So it's a downloading from higher centers. It's difficult to know that there's anything that isn't downloaded from higher centers. So I've put AT has the potential to balance the endocrine activity. And I think it does, because it can balance anything. As I say, it's not a cure for anything, but it can influence. I mean, like Pia's account of what happened with her menstrual cycle, and James's, that she has, it just shows that how changing the what's coming from the higher consciousness can actually target the end. The end point is the organ, or the function. So we've got, does anybody want to, I'll go on to the disorders of the endocrine system. So diabetes mellitus, or diabetes as we know it, is loss of insulin producing cells. So the pancreas secretes insulin. And this is loss of insulin-producing cells, either total, which is type 1, or partial type 2. So we know that type 1 is a complete wipeout of the function of the pancreas tends to occur younger, and it is thought that it's either an autoimmune disease or as a result perhaps an infection. It's not entirely clear, but it is, if you had your the insulin wiped out by either an autoimmune disease or infection of some sort, then without insulin, you die. And insulin, as you probably know, was discovered in 1922 by two researchers, Banting and Best. And we, you know, we're familiar with the use of insulin for diabetics. So insulin regulates carbohydrate metabolism and controls the blood sugar. The release of insulin from the pancreas is stimulated and controlled by eating. So unless we've got type 1 diabetes, the next one is pretty well under our control. And we all know about the rise in diabetes, massive epidemic of type 2 diabetes, and why that is undoubtedly triggered by diet. And carbohydrate, this sugars, carbohydrate that's easily broken down into glucose, such as sugars, cause a steep rise in blood sugar, needing a corresponding insulin response. Complex carbohydrates are slower to break down into sugars and have a more gradual insulin response. So that again comes to our diet. If we're eating things that are simple sugars, they're more likely to put up our things. And diet is an essential thing to look at here. Is anybody, yes?
I just get, what did you just say then? That what simple sugars,
yeah.
And your voice went for a moment.
Simple sugars are broken down very, they're a carbohydrate. Sugars, yes, are carbohydrate. There are simple sugars and complex carbohydrates.
Yeah.
Simple carbohydrates and complex. Simple carbohydrates are the sugars, all the sugars.
Right.
Fructose, glucose, lactose, this, that, the other. And so if we eat anything that has predominantly that's not just necessarily eating a sweet, is the sugars are the simple sugars are found in many, many, many foodstuffs.
Mm.
And the complex carbohydrates have got much more in the way of fibers, which, you know, would be vegetables and certain breads and so on, which have a glycemic index. We had that, you know, there are some foods that have a high glycemic index and some that have a low one. I think really at the end of the day, it means you've got to chew a bit more.
That's very good advice.
If you can't chew it, it's probably no good for you.
Yeah, if you can eat it by sucking only, no.
Absolutely, yeah. You don't, if it melts in your mouth, that's bad.
But they say this anyway, don't they? That actually our digestive, you know, we should all be chewing far more, and that there's far too much processed food, which doesn't require chewing.
Yes, it's fast because you
can eat it quickly because you're not chewing as we should. I've gone off on a tangent.
No, they're absolutely right. You're absolutely right, Jane.
Mm.
And the obesity epidemic, going into a supermarket and seeing that there are two whole lanes of crisps and sweets. And I wonder how much diabetes there was in the war.
Yeah.
I think probably a lot less. I never had a sweet until I was probably six. No sweets whatsoever. I was born before the war, and there were no sweets, no ice cream. My mother made them, but there were no biscuits, nothing like that. So I think that's why I have an absolute passion for sweets, which I do. Oh dear, yeah. I dreamt of them, something I dreamt of them, I longed for them. It was all going to be wonderful after the war. And it wasn't, it wasn't. Anyway, so we've got, so diabetes, you are going to come across people who either come to you because they've got it or because it's part, they have got it, but they've got something else. So if we look at what can happen with diabetes, it's pretty global. You've got vascular, which affects the heart, the arteries, and the brain. So, I mean, I think you probably know of amputations and losing toes and things like that. With that, that's the vascular, that's the larger vessels. At the same time, up in your brain, up here, are little micro bleeds, which are knocking off your brain cells. So that can lead to dementia and peripheral neuropathy. So it's pretty nasty. And then you've got cataracts, and the diabetes can cause kidney failure. So treatment is by lifestyle changes, diet, exercise, insulin, or drugs. So diabetes is a life sentence, but livable with. And I think that's the key of where the autogenic practice can come in. You know, you're not going to cure it, but it's livable with. So you're going to give someone something that where they can help it. AT may stimulate insulin production, so this is important. Blood sugar monitoring is very important, and the insulin dose may need to be adjusted. AT can support life changes and attitudes. So yes, we're dealing with the parasympathetic. We're switching to the parasympathetic. The parasympathetic is about rest and repair and renewal and digestion. If you're having digestion, you're going to have all the secretory enzymes for digestion enhanced, and insulin is one of them. So, if you've got someone who is on insulin, you would want them to be quite particular about, well, first of all, you want to know when they checked their that the blood sugar monitoring now they have is far advanced. I think there are continuous monitorings, and certainly there are gadgets and things where you do a pinprick. So that I think if you've got someone who has got diabetes, they will have their own way of actually checking this, and you want to check what they're doing already, and then make sure that they continue to do that and look at the results. Because it may be that they need less insulin. And that would be something. If you've got someone who is on insulin, they're usually pretty au fait with their diet and their insulin injections. And if it changes, they may themselves know quite how to adjust it, because there are many people with diabetes who adjust according to what they're eating. So it's much more refined than it used to be. So I think if you find out how they're doing it and when they're doing it, you'll probably find that they are experienced enough to alter things if they need to. Failing that, they would need to go back to their clinician, and that's often a diabetic nurse. But I think, you know, you would just work with them to find out. It wouldn't be much, but it's important to know, and it's important to know how they're doing it, when they're doing it, what the results are, and if it changes.
Can I add a little thing there,
Yeah.
Anne? Because I mean, I wouldn't have a clue about the results and what the blood levels should be, and that isn't our job. But of course, it is about looking for change, isn't it? But there's one client I had who, in his regular, went off to the consultant. I don't know, was it twice a year or something, just to have an overview, etc., etc. And the consultant was absolutely astonished that one of the results had come out with a far lower score than it ever had before in looking after this guy who was in his 60s, and I can't remember if he was on insulin or not, I can't remember that. But anyway, it was a far lower score than had ever shown up before. And everybody was surprised, and so was my client. And he showed me it, and I'm afraid it meant nothing to me. I can't even tell you what it was, what the essence was, and what the score was, which I think was 24. But I had no idea what that means. But apparently,
24 blood sugar, 24 is pretty high.
Yes, it wasn't blood sugar. This was some other much more detailed test, which it was a whole row of things. Okay, so it was one item that I had never known that about. All I'm saying is, everyone was astounded at how low that had got to. Forget 24, that's probably my mistake. Whatever it was a far lower score than before. And I was shown the previous ones and they were high. Yeah. And the guy said, I'm eating exactly the same and nothing has changed in my life except doing autogenic training.
Okay.
So that's the essence of what I'm saying without the detail.
Well, it can change. I think, it's always interesting to look things up. And if it's relevant, look up, because if you're working with someone with diabetes and they're getting they are reading their blood sugar levels, it might be useful to know that and to know what's high and what's normal and what's this. I mean, there's also hypoglycemia, which is when, the blood sugar goes too low, and that's when they've had too much insulin. And that's why it's important, because if by any chance, you've got someone who has... are on insulin and the autogenic practice affects it tremendously, or they didn't do this and they have a hypoglycemia, that's much more instant and needing treatment than, so if you have hypoglycemia, you have to have some sugar, some glucose available. But it's all about knowing before you set off, being aware of something. You don't sort of say, oh, this is going to happen. It might or it might not, but you being aware of it and having a discussion about it is the important thing. And then you know where we are. You know where your client is with their condition. There might be someone who is actually very irregular and erratic, which is not good, and that doesn't do them any good. And there'll be someone who perhaps newly diagnosed and is absolutely fed up with the whole thing and can't deal with it. There are all manner of things, which is why the 80 and the life, they've got to make lifestyle adjustments and so on. And they're pretty fed up about it and anxious about it and so on and so forth. So the 80 can be a resource to support all of that, plus the fact that it might directly improve their condition. So that needs to be watched. Thyroid disease, that's another. Oh yes, Bev.
Yes, yeah. I just had a question about the insulin side of things and AT, and how was it discovered that AT can affect the production of insulin?
As I said, autogenic training actually enhances digestion. It enhances digestion because if we go back to basics, you are switching from the using up tension, active stress part of you, the sympathetic drive, to the parasympathetic. And in the physiology of the parasympathetic, you have an enhanced digestion. Why do you have an enhanced digestion? Because you need to actually take in all the nourishment to repair and renew that. So the digestion, the saliva in the mouth, the increased actually bowel activity, and the pancreas is part of digestion. It's one of the enzymes that helps digestion. So if you're enhancing digestion, then you're likely to actually stimulate. If there's any insulin-producing cells left, they can be supported. If they've been wiped out by disease or whatever, then that's probably about it. But they usually are some, in that, and in which case you can actually enhance their action. Does that make sense to you? Yeah. Yes, Jane.
Well, I was just approaching Bev's question from a slightly different angle, because that brilliant explanation of how, but how was it discovered? I'm wondering if you're wondering about research, or Bev, because the Schultz did a lot of clinical research. I don't know all the dates of all this stuff, but of course it's very old. And they did do studies on quite a lot of hormones. I think they did a lot of clinical studies, and it did show all kinds of movement with people who had or hadn't done autogenic training. And so it did come to light through those research projects.
I didn't know that.
Well, I think that was where he was saying it is showing that it's a normalizing process. People with high blood pressure, it tends to come down. People with low blood pressure, it tends to come up. So they were doing those sorts of, and then realized actually it's not addressing something specific, as you've said, Anne. It's about what the whole systems are doing, self-normalizing.
Well, that's going on, Jane, and all of these specific things are all amalgamating in the middle of one person, and they're all doing it all the time.
These are the
individual contributions to health and well-being, or to life, and they come together in one person. So let's let's get on to thyroid disease. We want to finish at 11, don't we?
Doesn't matter if you go to quarter past, that's fine.
Okay, probably quarter past. Yeah, okay. So the thyroid disease, I think it's a familiar one. And the thyroid gland produces thyroxine, which acts like an accelerator and increases metabolic rate. So that's quite easy to understand. You're driving a car and you put your foot on the accelerator and you use up the petrol a lot quicker, don't you? Well, it's the same with thyroxine. You have increased thyroxine and you're ticking over at a much higher rate. So there are all sorts of consequences of this. You have, I'll tell you about the AT and thyroid. I'll just go through what happens. You have a fast pulse, you have a tremor, and you're hot. You lose weight. You have exophthalmos. Now, this is an unusual one, and this is not always part of this, but if some people get, which is when, for some reason, the eyeball is pushed forwards and the muscles behind tighten and push it forward so that you have protruding eyes. And it's this causes not only how you look, which is very odd. There was a comedian who had exophthalmos. I can't remember his name.
Was it Marty Feldman?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Well done, Jane. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thea, you wanted to say something. Thea?
Yeah, I'm just thinking about him too.
Oh, Martin Feldman, yes. So you have a Martin Feldman look, which is very difficult to live with. But it isn't just that. Your eyelids can't close very well. And so your eyeball and the conjunctiva and even the cornea is exposed to more than it should be. So that's quite a problem. And with exophthalmos, it's the one thing, as I'm remembering, that does not respond to treatment of the thyroid. You're stuck with it. There are also anxiety. Imagine my heart's racing, I'm tremoring, I'm hot, panics, sleeplessness. So we've got a whole thing there. It's interesting is that the anxiety and the panics and the sleeplessness can be something that you're presented with anyway when it hasn't been diagnosed. So I've had people who've had undiagnosed thyrotoxicosis when they've had those things, have those symptoms, anxiety, panics, and sleeplessness. So the autogenic training can be very, very pertinent for that. And this is, what have we got to, oh yes, underactivity. So how do we treat, let's do underactivity causes what we call hypothyroid or myxedema. And you get the slow pulse, you get weight gain, constipation, a cold, dry skin, loss of hair, mental changes, memory loss, or depression. Now, again, if you put those symptoms together in a mild form, is it almost say, you know, yes, you get older, you have all of those. So people commonly think they've got an underactive thyroid and go to their doctor saying, it must be my thyroid, it must be my thyroid, give me some thyroid pills. Because it does, again, it does cross over with other aspects, and not specifically the thyroid. Just as having anxiety, panics, and sleeplessness can present in a milder form and cannot be recognized until the thyroid is tested. If you're going to treat the overactivity, you're given medication, carbamazepine, or you have surgery. You can also get cancer of the thyroid. Has anybody had any experience of thyroid disease, one way or the other? Jane?
I had a benign lump which sat there for a couple of years, not showing any trouble at all. I had no symptoms apart from what it looked like. And in the end, they took it out because they said it's not doing anything now, but let's do it for safety. So I had a partial thyroidectomy, but they didn't have to replace any thyroid or anything. I was absolutely fine. So
that would be a non-functioning goiter, as they said.
I was never told that, but yes, that makes sense.
Well, the goiter is the enlargement of the gland, and historically there was the Derbyshire neck, and the Derbyshire neck was because the county of Derbyshire is furthest away from the sea, and it doesn't get any iodine. Lack of iodine. Yep. And so it was a common condition in Derbyshire to have a goiter. Yeah. And you could have a goiter, which was actually an increased size of the thyroid, like Jane did, which doesn't actually overproduce. Yeah. Or you can have a goiter which has got more tissue and is desperately trying to be normal. And that would be the Derbyshire thing. So it increases in size to produce more, but you can also have a goiter or a swelling of the thyroid, which is overproduction. So that's the Derbyshire neck. The treatment of the thyroid is either carbamazepine or radioactive iodine, or actually surgery. So replacement therapy. Now, the thing about treating particularly, I think, the thyroid disease and also treating any endocrine disease, I mean, any of the female things like ovarian problems, if you've got something like, you say, all right, you can just take a pill. Well, it sounds all right, but strangely, or even perhaps understandably, if you've got something that's not working and functioning quite right, and the level of hormone isn't quite right, just sticking in a pill may or may not make it right. And it can often be really difficult to get you normalized by taking pills, because it is not the same as producing it yourself. So the adjustment of endocrinology can be quite troublesome. you know, as the same with insulin, getting the right dose of insulin, and there are people who are unstable. So it isn't just as straightforward, you've got that much missing, we'll put that much in, because it's not, even though they are produced and they are chemically exactly the same, they're not biochemists, they are actual chemicals that you're putting in. So there is this nuance and this balance that takes a while. Some people, fine, take a couple of pills, much better. Other people never get it right. And that can certainly be the case with the diabetic. Anybody else want to say anything about the thyroid? Okay. The last one I've got here is the adrenal glands. I've put there that the conditions of the adrenal glands are rare. So you've got, and obviously the adrenal glands produce adrenaline, which we are very familiar with in our work, and cortisol, which again we're familiar with. And they're both produced by the adrenal glands that sit on top of the kidneys. So a pheochromocytoma is a tumor arising in the medulla of the adrenal gland with hypersecretion of adrenaline and noradrenaline, causing symptoms similar to hypothyroidism with additional rise in blood pressure. They're rare. But, you know, these things are or are not diagnosed. It's rare. It's not uncommon to have hypothyroidism. It's uncommon to have a pheochromocytoma. And there are different features. And Addison's disease is the failure of the adrenal medulla with hypersecretion of catecholamine is difficult to diagnose. So there we've got that's I got that wrong actually. Addison's disease is a failure of the adrenal cortex, where you've got hypersecretion of cortisol. Cortisol actually has if you start with adrenaline and then there's cortisol, adrenaline is immediate and dealt with and got rid of. Cortisol has a much deeper and longer acting action. It actually affects the blood pressure. It affects it actually breaks down muscles. It reduces inflammation. It has a very many actions, which is why it's used, and particularly has been used dermatologically. But it has its problems. If you use cortisone treatment for eczema, which is an inflammatory condition, and I remember when cortisol was first put out as a dermatological solution to eczema, it was brilliant. And then people were putting it on their face and they got secondary changes in the skin. So cortisol is something that has to be used with care. If you take cortisone for any long period of time, you can have trouble, you can have raised blood pressure, you can have cataracts. So it is actually a problem, and it is only used mostly for short periods of time. So complex work from the endocrine system. I haven't put the parathyroid hormones, because they regulate, they're four little glands, they regulate calcium metabolism, which is very complicated, and I don't think you need to worry about it, except to say that it's complicated, and I've never quite understood it myself. But they regulate calcium, and occasionally they have trouble with the parathyroids. The testes, I haven't done the testes, and the ovaries produce estrogen, progesterone. I actually think that's enough information. What I'm saying is I'm just sort of given an outline of what crops up, and to remember that you're not treating anything, you're interested in it, you find out about it, you're open to that condition cropping up in whatever you're working with, because you actually have known about it, you have it in the back of your mind if something is happening, and actually knowing that what you're teaching is globally regulating a lot of these systems, which is a very, very good thought, I think, isn't it? A very, very good thought. And we've heard how it certainly can. Okay, I think, shall we stop for coffee?
Let's stop for coffee.
Was that an hour and a half?
That was lovely. That was absolutely lovely. It was an hour and a half. I think, no, I don't, it don't, doesn't matter what the time is, actually, Anne, on this one. As I said, we just slotted some times in, but yes, since you're doing both sessions, it's however has developed. So okay, if we have coffee now at 25 past 11,